Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Thanks for listening to this Institute of Art and Ideas podcast, bringing you philosophy for our times. Here at the IAI, we're committed to taking philosophy out of dusty books and lecture halls and into the heart of public life. If you enjoy this debate and want to carry on the discussion, or watch over 1,000 more debates and talks on all the latest issues in philosophy, science, politics and arts, visit iai.tv. Remember to subscribe and review on iTunes.
So welcome everybody to this event on doing right and feeling good. And the theme of this debate is that we think empathising with others is the route to a better world. But studies show that empathy encourages us to help one named child over 10 anonymous others. So is morality strangely not about empathy at all? Does the moral way to act have more to do with thinking than feeling? Or is empathy a vital force for good? And I'm very pleased to welcome for this debate Anders Sandberg here, who is James Martin Fellow at the Future of Humanity Institute at Oxford University. And his research centres on the ethical implications of future technologies. Peter Dews, to my left, is Professor of Philosophy at the University of Essex. Peter is a leading scholar in critical theory and post-Kantian philosophy, and he's the author of The Idea of Evil. And Simon Baron-Cohen is Professor of Psychology at the University of Cambridge, and his books include The Science of Evil and The Essential Difference. So, for the beginning of this debate, I'd like to ask our three speakers to set out their position, three minutes or so to make their pitch, and I'm going to ask Anders to start us off.
Thank you. So the previous session in here was about evil, so now we're going to do the good side, trying to do good in the world. And I think the core question here is, how much does emotion have to do with that? Maybe what's love got to do with it, but it might be more about compassion or other warm-hearted feelings. And traditionally, philosophers have been a bit divided about this. David Hume famously said that, no, it's our passions that are driving our moral reasoning. But quite a lot of philosophers have felt that no, doing the right thing has very little to do with feeling it. You want to do the correct thing. The right thing is a correct thing, and that means that you need to reason well about it. Now, the most extreme example might be Kant, who would have argued that emotions get in the way of reasoning through what you should be doing, what you ought to be doing. And similarly, you have many utilitarians who might argue that actually you should calculate what's the most good and then do that. Now, the problem might of course be, where do we get the good from? And you could argue that actually the good is those wonderful positive feelings, either from a purely hedonistic perspective or some more refined form of action. I help people and I find that meaningful, even if it's kind of painful and effortful to do that helpful thing. And that meaning, that is another reason. But from an abstract standpoint, we might also want to take a step back and say, if we want to do good in the world, shouldn't we try to actually maximize the good? And this is where the consequentialists and the other ethicists really get apart. Because the consequentialists generally say, yes, it's the consequences of an action that matter. And that means that even if I have really crazy motivations, if I reliably do a lot of things that are good and proper, I'm doing good things, and that's what matters. Meanwhile, the Kantians would say, hey, wait a minute, your intentions are all screwed up, Anders. You can't really, even though you're helping orphans and making the environment cleaner, you're doing that for totally misguided, perverted reasons. It's all tainted. to the consequential would say, yeah, but if Anders is crazy and is doing good efficiently, we should be just happy about that. So I think this is what the debate is going to be about. And my position is, actually, I think consequentialism, even if you think that Kant has a lot of to offer, if you can save two kids rather than one kid, you should be saving two kids. Even if you're a Kantian, you would agree that saving more people would be a good thing, even though your motivations might be a bit weird.
Okay, thank you, Anders. So, Peter?
Well, just one quick point in relation to Anders' last point. What if the one child was your son or daughter? You know, what would be the right thing to do as opposed to the two children? That's obviously a very long-standing issue in philosophy. I just wanted to make a few points about the kind of polarity in this debate. One is that we have, it seems quite a good idea to make sort of empathy the basis of morality. And in the 19th century, Schopenhauer was the great philosopher who did that. He thought that what he called Mitleid, which is literally suffering with, which is like etymologically the same as compassion or sympathy, was the very basis of ethics. But he had a whole metaphysics behind that. So he thought that actually when you feel compassion, it's not just your sort of replicating the feelings of another person, but the kind of metaphysical barrier between yourself and the other self is kind of dissolving or breaking down. And he thought that ultimately we are all one. We are at the metaphysical level, we are just one consciousness. So he was very influenced by Oriental philosophy, Buddhist and Hindu philosophy. But you might not want to buy that whole metaphysical package, and I'm sure that Simon wouldn't want to do that. as regards the more rational, so you might, the problem with empathy is that it might be too particularistic. You know, you might think, well, it's very easy to empathize with people who are like you racially, culturally, sociologically, and so forth. But it's also very easy to kind of ostracize or demonize people who are not like you. So there seem to be limits to empathy. It doesn't have sufficient scope. So throughout the history of philosophy, some thinkers have said, no, we need something more rational, as Anders was saying. Well, what are the problems with that? Well, the utilitarian view is, well, we should strive for the greatest happiness of the greatest number. That seems fairly obvious. But in the everyday situation, how on earth could you ever calculate that? It's just an impossible, how could you ever know what you were doing would in the end lead to the greatest happiness of the greatest number of human beings? It involves a kind of level of abstraction and calculation which is just totally remote from everyday life and the situations in which we make moral decisions. A view which is also very universalist is that of Immanuel Kant, but in a way it's closer to our everyday situation, because Kant's basic view is you should not, to put it in a nutshell, you should not make an exception for yourself. That's the basic idea of morality. He puts it in more flowery language. He says that the maxim of your action, in other words, the principle on which you act, you should also be able to will as a universal law. So basically he's saying the principle on which you act, so if you think it's okay not to return your library books, implicitly you're saying it's okay for nobody to return their library books. And then there wouldn't be any books in the library. So that would be pretty self-defeating. So you have to will that your principle should be a universal principle. And that's in a way, a very rationalistic way of thinking about ethics, but it is very universalistic. Well, what's the problem with that? What might be the problem with that? Well, there's one notorious article by Kant, which is called something like On a Supposed Right to Lie Out of a Respect for Humanity. And he sets up a situation in which there is someone with a knife pursuing someone, and their victim has disappeared into a house. And the intending murderer says, "Where did that person go?" And Kant says, "You have to tell the truth. You have to say he went into the house." Because there's an absolute moral prohibition against lying. Yeah, and most people have thought, wow, he's lost it. however convincing he might be in general, this is taking things too far. There's an interesting codicil to that. His further argument is, well, say you misled the intending murderer and said he went that away, okay? And you told a lie. If in fact the intended victim didn't go into the house but did go that away, and the murderer killed him, you'd be responsible because you told a lie which sent the murderer in the right direction. But if you said he went into the house and he did go into the house, even if the guy got killed, you wouldn't be responsible. So you can see the convolutions. So there's something, there's something worrying about that level of abstraction. I mean, what I wanted to do, just by in a quick few closing remarks, is to suggest a third alternative. There are some moral philosophers in the 20th century, and two most famous examples are Immanuel Levinas, a famous French-Jewish philosopher, and a Danish philosopher called Løgstrup. I'm sure I haven't pronounced that correctly, but...
I'm Swedish, I can't pronounce Danish either.
Who thought that the basis of morality was neither rationalism in the form of utilitarianism or Kantianism, nor empathy, but something like a kind of innate respect for another human being. Levinas called it the face-to-face. He just thought that when you encounter another human being, your kind of default response is a sense of respect. Here is someone whose body and whose integrity I should not infringe on, that I should respect. So that's not really, he didn't think that was empathy, he thought that was something even more basic, an awareness of the humanity in another human being. And Løgstrup's got a very similar idea. He calls it the absolute moral demand, that just when you, your awareness that we're all interwoven in life, that we depend on each other, we have to trust each other, just produces this intrinsic sense of a need to respect the other. Now, that's not to say that it can't go wrong, that it can't be obliterated, it can't be distorted, and so on. But he just, both of these thinkers think there's a kind of default position, and it's not empathy, so it doesn't have the problems of empathy, but neither is it rationalistic in the way that some moral theories are.
Thank you. Okay, Simon?
So for me, the big question is how do we develop a moral code? Because I think we'll all agree that human beings need a moral compass to guide their behaviour. And, is empathy necessary? And indeed the best way to end up with a moral compass? Or is a more logic-based, rational approach the best way to end up with a moral compass? And I would sort of argue that actually there are many routes to developing morality. The key thing is that children grow up with a concept of morality about what's good and what's not good. But how they get there doesn't really matter. So there are different routes to the same developmental outcome. One route is empathy-based. So we see somebody else in pain or suffering, and we have a very immediate emotional or affective response. You know, we see the victims of the tsunami and we want to do something about it. We donate money, for example. Or we see the refugees coming into the jungle in Calais and we feel this is wrong, we want to do something about it. But it might be at a very emotional level, and I would say that's the empathy-based route. The other approach could be a sort of logic-based approach, what I call systemizing, where you try to understand, in this case, human behavior or the way society works through a system of rules, and you try to make a judgment about what's right and wrong based on rules. And again, that could be a perfectly valid way to end up with a moral position, a moral compass. So one example of that would be the golden rule of treat others the way you would like to be treated. And that's, you can arrive at that through pure logic because it seems to be the fairest for everybody. So I think you could go down these two different routes to end up with a moral compass, a moral code. You could also imagine that some people use a hybrid, and I think that's probably what I'll argue, that we have our capacity for empathy that can be elicited very spontaneously when we see somebody else suffering, and it impels us to want to help them, to reduce their distress. We can also not just follow our emotions, we can use our logic and our system of rules that we've developed. But I would sort of argue against Bloom's position. You know, Bloom says, you know, don't rely on empathy when you're trying to figure out what's the right thing to do, because empathy will mislead us at times, or it will cloud our judgment. Just rely on logic. And I think that that pure reliance on logic carries dangers. You know, you could argue that when Hitler came up with the so-called final solution of how to make Germany better, he was using a kind of cold logic, and that led to the creation of a killing machine which would ultimately improve the German race, the German economy. There was a kind of logic behind it. But because of the absence of empathy for the victims of that machine, logic alone led to tragedy. So, you know, I think where we're looking at how do we cultivate a moral compass in children, we should probably be encouraging both an empathy-based approach and a rule-based or systems-based approach. The last point I'll just throw in is that I'm a psychologist, and I work with people with autism. And one view of autism is that these are individuals who struggle with empathy. Does that mean that people with autism are going to end up without a moral compass? Or, you know, does it mean that their morality is going to be very skewed if they're purely relying on a kind of logic-based approach to deciding what counts as good? If we break down empathy into two components, and this was something I mentioned in the previous session, the sort of cognitive empathy, where it's all about recognizing someone else's feelings and thoughts, and then an affective empathy, which is all about emotionally responding to someone else's thoughts and feelings. People with autism struggle with the first kind. If they have to read facial expressions or body language, they might find that very confusing. But interestingly, that doesn't lead them to hurt other people. Typically, it leads them to avoid other people because they find other people's behavior very confusing. But the affective part of empathy seems to be intact in people with autism. If they hear that other people are suffering, it upsets them and they want to do something about it. Interestingly, people with autism love rules. They like things to be well specified, and they like things to be unambiguous. So a legal system which really clearly defines what you can and can't do, they might seize upon as black and white, that people should follow the rules. And that can often lead people with autism to be hyper-moral, that they become the whistleblowers in situations where people are breaking the rules. So far from their difficulties with cognitive empathy leading them to be immoral, if anything, their strong love of systems and rules, combined with their ability to, or their capacity to have affective empathy, to care about other people, means that they do indeed end up as highly moral.
The debate. Theme one.
Well, thank you, Simon. That's a very useful distinction, I think, between understanding another person's predicament and feeling their predicament. But can we just, I want to turn to you, Peter, as our philosopher, to ask if we actually understand what we mean by the term empathy, because somebody, another speaker just before this session told me that actually the word sympathy used to mean what we now understand as empathy, you know, feeling somebody else's suffering. But then the word sympathy actually changed to the meaning that it has now, which sort of carries a kind of condescending, almost a kind of lip service connotation, that I feel your pain, when you don't, actually. Whereas empathy is more on a level that you're engaging with, or putting yourself in somebody else's shoes. So what is it? What can, as a philosopher, what's the definition of empathy? And there might be disagreement on this.
Well, that's really it's hard to define. I mean, as regards sympathy. I mean, all these words have the same sort of etymological structure. So, sim pathos in ancient Greek means feeling with. So in Latin, that is com passion. That's exactly the same structure. And in German, it's mit light, which is mit with light suffering. So all these words mean the same thing, suffering with or feeling with. But I think you're right that that this notion of sympathy did take on a tone of condescension. And maybe that's one of the, I haven't studied the history of empathy as a word, but it seems that it has come in to suggest a more egalitarian relationship in which we are sort of, as it were, feeling or reproducing what the other person is feeling. I mean, one I think interesting aspect of this, this whole debate we're having, is that it does have a kind of gendered dimension. About 30 years ago now, there's the American psychologist called Carol Gilligan published a book called In a Different Voice, in which she suggested that males and females have different orientations towards morality, that males are more rule-oriented, whereas women are more care-oriented. And she said you could even see this in the playground. If you go into a playground in an infant school, you know, the boys will spend hours discussing and working out the rules of the game before they actually start playing. They're kind of obsessed with setting up the rules. Whereas girls tend not to play in that way. Maybe you disagree, but...
nature or nurture.
Exactly. Well, then this raises a big nature. You know, some feminists hate this because, you know, she seems to be saying, oh, women are all touchy-feely and men are the ones who know how to stick to rules. But one example she gives is that she set moral problems and put them to girls and boys. And one problem was, you know, if there's a man whose wife is desperately ill but he can't afford the medicine, is he entitled to break into the pharmacy and just steal the medicine? And the boys would tend to say, yeah, of course, you know, a human life is more important than burglary. He should just break into the pharmacy and steal the medicine. Whereas the girls would tend to say, well, he should go and talk to the pharmacist and explain the situation that his wife is in, and maybe they can reach some kind of arrangement, and so on and so forth.
Well, perhaps those girls have been inculcated to act in that, conditioned to act in that way from day one. Although, Simon, I know you work on the gender differences in brains from a very young age. But maybe you might have a different view. But I was actually interested. I'll ask Anders first. I want to come back to you on a question about neurological responses and their role in empathy. But Anders, can we talk about the difference between empathy and altruism, or whether they are in fact a binary opposition? Because actually, you might think it feels good to be empathetic. You get that sort of warm, fuzzy feeling, a fellow feeling. But actually, does it feel good to be empathetic? Because you then feel somebody's pain. You experience their suffering, as it were, and actually isn't that rather similar to altruism, putting yourself out of it?
Yeah, I think there is an important aspect of altruism where you try to generalize, you try to be universal. Empathy is typically how we start with that. I vividly remember in school when my class had been treating a young teacher rather badly. And she was in tears. This was her first class ever, and it was a total shambles. She couldn't control it at all, and then it was time for the next lesson. And I remained and tried to comfort the poor teacher. At that point, I felt very, very bad, because I felt how badly she felt. And then I came to the next lesson, and I was, of course, late, because I'd been trying to comfort this poor teacher. And the rest of the class had covered for me. They had come up with a nice explanation. Oh, Anders wasn't feeling very well, he's a bit delayed. And that made me actually feel really happy about my classmates. Yeah, they're really treating that poor teacher badly, but they also could show a kind of joint coordination. about one of her own. Now, looking back at this, of course, wait a minute, why did they choose to help me rather than be nice to the poor teacher? And the real answer is, of course, I was one of the members of the group. So that empathy was, in a sense, acting in a somewhat bad way. They had a degree of altruism, like kids have at that age, but it was reserved for a certain group. And generally, our ability to feel empathy is diminishing with distance. While we can abstract altruism, it's again much easier to be altruistic about people who are like us. But once you start feeling a bit for a group, you can expand the circle of concern and you can abstract it away. Quite often you might need a trigger. A friend of mine, she had been following the Syrian refugee crisis, and then she saw the pictures of that poor boy who drowned. And that was the trigger. Now she started being very active and actually trying to help the situation on a fairly abstract level, donating money, coordinating people, not actually going to Greece and helping people out of the waves, but trying to get it to work on a high level. So here the empathy triggered altruism. But altruism, you can take that on a very abstract level. So I think we're going to get more into this later on, but our institute are sharing offices with the Center for Effective Altruism, which are really hardcore consequentialists who are trying to maximize the amount of good they do in the world. And quite a lot of that is on a very abstract level. There are not that many pictures on the wall of starving children. It's more a question of at the whiteboard about the statistics, how can we maximize the amount of quality-adjusted life years we save per year, per dollar? Which is very good for a lot of people. But many people say that is kind of rather remote from the warm heart we normally think about when dealing with compassion. I think this can be rather useful because it actually saves a lot of people. But the question is, how do you motivate yourself to do it? And I think the motor, quite often, is the more human empathy. That feeling that, oh, I feel with that person, even the person on the television screen, my heart goes out to them, and that makes me want to do something. But then hopefully that energy, it goes to my brain, and I figure out, what can I do to help the most?
Well, it's really interesting, and we're going to go on to talk about pragmatic impacts on the world in a moment. But it's very interesting that you bring up the news media and how that's perhaps changing our the way that we empathise or not, and the fact that in some ways, you know, the world is in our living rooms through 24-hour news and so on, but in other ways, we're quite detached, and the other people's plight is mediated through the news. And so. But so, Simon, I mean, you work on the brain, which is a fixed thing in some ways. But so, I'm interested in, you know, in how people empathise. Is it that you empathise with people that you know? Is it people that are like you? I mean, the case of Aylan Cody, I think he sort of looked similar to children that perhaps we might be familiar with meeting in the West, and that had an effect perhaps there. Perhaps problematically in a way, is it that we see suffering and it's just the witnessing suffering? So neurologically or cognitively, how does empathy happen?
So first of all, picking up on your first comment about the brain is fixed, I don't think the brain is fixed. I mean, it's a very dynamic organ. It's developing all the time, but also it's responding situationally all the time. So, you know, fixed is probably the opposite of what the brain is and does, and the notion of plasticity is also quite important here in terms of our ability to learn, so to take in new information. But in terms of, you know, what's the brain doing when we empathise? Nowadays, scientists can look at the brain using brain imaging, and particularly functional brain imaging, where you perhaps present the person who's lying in the scanner with an image of somebody suffering or an image of somebody's facial expression, and actually look at which bits of the brain are activated when they're seeing somebody else in distress or having an emotion. And it turns out that empathy doesn't reside in a single part of the brain. There's a whole network of regions. Some of them are cortical, like the ventromedial prefrontal cortex in the frontal lobes. Some of them are subcortical in the limbic system, like the amygdala. But you know, these are different regions that respond in to different aspects of emotional stimuli. And you know, you can find individual differences in reactivity or response in these different brain regions. So that could help us understand why some people show more empathy than others. The activity of these brain regions may be higher in some individuals than others. But that's, of course, begging the question of why. And if we're trying to understand what gives rise to individual differences in empathy, we have to look at both social factors, the experience that you've had as a child, and biological factors, your genes, your hormones, and other biological, for example, neurotransmitters that all contribute to the response of this empathy circuit in the brain.
Do you want to hear more from the world's leading thinkers? If the answer to that question is yes, subscribe to IAI.tv for unlimited access to thousands of debates, talks, articles, academy courses, and live events. Are you bored of the surface-level news, politics, sports, and entertainment coverage on your newsfeed? Go deeper. Get the philosophy behind the news and get the latest big ideas from the world's leading thinkers on subjects at the core of the human condition, life, the universe, and everything in between. It's free for the first month, and there's no commitment to pay, so subscribe now to understand the world beyond the surface level.
Okay.
So. And it's worth recognizing that this is an evolved system. If you look at other mammals, it seems like you find various levels of empathy in other forms of mammals. And of course, if you're a social creature and need to rear your young, you need to be able to feel for them to some extent. And the more social and the more complex the representation become, of course, the more you extend that. So that's why you can see that even mice sometimes help each other, even though there is nothing in it for them. They recognize that that other mouse is in distress, and if I press this lever, they get out of the cage. While monkeys have more advanced systems. And some of this interesting overlaps, of course, with what people in neuroethics are interested in for the neural basis of moral cognition. There is an interesting ongoing discussion about some of these brains, that are how the role they play when we make a moral decision. Because in some cases, people seem to be using more of a dorsolateral frontal cortex to make a kind of reasoned argument. And sometimes the amygdala just charges on and they follow a moral intuition. And there is a very hearty quarrel among different ethicists about what that actually tells us about morality and how we should be thinking. But it's pretty clear that that empathy is quite densely interwoven with the systems we actually use when making moral decisions.
But I think you were asking, you know, what triggers us to show empathy and then hopefully to do good. And for different people, it's different kind of triggers. So for people who needed that photograph of the child who had drowned, you know, they needed to see this was a real child and it was somebody's child before they could actually understand the plight of the refugees. But you know, the idea that our empathy circuit in the brain is only triggered by seeing cues from our own group and the dangers of using empathy in terms of we're only going to favour our own group. I just don't think that's, you know, that's actually the case. You know, when we heard about the tsunami, which happened far away to a different group, many people, for them, just hearing the news, that was a sufficient trigger to want to donate, for example. So I don't think empathy is kind of limited by your ethnic group, your social group, although it's obviously easily manipulated in that way.
Theme 2.
Okay, so I'd like to move on now to talk about how to be effective. What are the most effective ways of doing good in the world, practically speaking, and looking to the future? And we all hear about the rise of data and, you know, all crunching data and aggregating data. So this is the kind of the big picture rather than perhaps those more individual relationships. And I imagine you crunching data at the Oxford Martin Institute. But how do you get people to do good if they don't have that incentive, that personal incentive to do so? How are you tackling that problem?
Well, the problem is more of incentive than the data. So a few years back, one of our local researchers, Toby Ord, started being serious about doing good in the world. He realized he didn't need the extra money he was earning, so he could give that to charity. And then, being a consequentialist, he wanted to give to the most effective charity. So he started trying to figure out which was the best place to put the money. And after a bit of studying, he discovered there had actually been investigations about the efficacy of different health interventions in Africa. And the difference was not just a few multiples, but it could be four orders of magnitude difference. In terms of quality-adjusted life years, you get per dollar. The number of lives you can save per dollar. This is a factor of 10,000. That's enormous. And this was not secret information. This was an old report from the World Health Organization gathering dust, because nobody had really bothered looking, or people had looked and said, oh yes, this is much more effective than that. And then they didn't do anything, because it was just dry numbers. What it really took was somebody realizing, hey, this matters a lot. I want to help a lot of people, and I better help them in the most maximally effective way. Yeah, I can certainly donate to anything, but if I donate to that, more people will be saved. So the crunching of data might be, it's important, because there's still a surprising amount we don't know about what's effective to do. But the real problem is, of course, can you motivate people to do it? And on one level, of course, you can show them a picture of a child in need. And it better be one child with one name, because as soon as you show 10 children in need, the willingness to donate goes down. And if you show a million children in need, oh yes, it's very abstract, it's very sad, but that's how the world is. But if it's little Maya, yeah, everybody wants to help. That's kind of crude. Ideally, you want people to first recognize that problem, and then recognize that this is something we ought to do. We ought to generalize beyond that. I don't want to be the kind of person who just donates to the named little kid, but actually helps a lot of kids. And that's typically how the effective altruists are getting people to realize that, yeah, we should try to be more effective about it. And you might be a Kantian and say, yeah, but it's really your intention to help that matters morally. But still, if your intention to help matters morally, you might still want to help as many as possible with that intention. And then, of course, I think mostly it's a matter of outreach. I'm just going to wave around with Will MacCaskill's book. Great book. I haven't written it, but it's kind of a nice one. But the main reason I was bringing it is actually that when you read through the list of chapters, how much can you achieve? How many people benefit and by how much? Is this the most effective thing you can do? Is this area neglected? What would have happened otherwise, and so on? There is very little talk here on compassion. It's all about altruism on a fairly intellectual level, and it's kind of noticeable that the effective altruist generally tends to be kind of coming from a philosophical, from an academic background, because they generally tend to start with that maximizing, optimizing mindset. That might not be for everybody, but I think it would be better if more people could generalize like that.
Peter, how do you respond to that?
Well, I mean, I just had some thoughts about the, you know, the kind of the Aylin Kurdi episode as the thing that triggered a lot of compassion and activity. And I think we've been discussing it so far as something very positive, you know, that suddenly there was this image that people responded to. But personally, I also find it rather worrying and disturbing, because prior to that, for months and months, we had been seeing pictures of people drowning in the Mediterranean. And you know, with very little input in people. In fact, you know, as you know, in the popular newspapers, these immigrants were being demonized, even though they were drowning in the sea. So although you might think it's very positive that suddenly there was a surge of response, I mean, I think we have to think, well, what were the cultural and sociological and media conditions for that image suddenly to go global, or to go viral, as we say? But not only that, that surge of response can also evaporate very quickly. So, for example, as soon as we had those incidents of sexual harassment in Cologne at New Year, you know, the sympathy for the immigrants in Germany sank very rapidly. So these kinds of fluctuations, and what's actually causing them in terms of the media, how the media is employed, what's impacting on us and so forth. I think we have to be much more conscious of that. It's not just a positive thing that we can sort of fluctuate up and down so so quickly in response to certain triggers.
But on this, on the strategic point, in terms of what Anders was saying about thinking about motivation being about maximising impact, do you have a philosophical disagreement with that, or a practical disagreement with that?
I don't have a practical disagreement, but I think it's absolutely right to say that, that sort of quoting figures and numbers and lacks, it doesn't actually grip people. It doesn't. There's got to be something more. There's got to be something more than that. And I do think that it's possible for us to break through these barriers of culture and ethnicity and so on and so forth. There are situations in which we're just aware that we are confronted with a human being in need, and that is something that we are capable of responding to. But you know, Levinas always talks, for example, always talks about the face-to-face. I've puzzled a lot about that over the years, because I've thought to myself, well, is he saying, well, you only really feel a moral obligation to someone you're directly in front of? Because that's a very familiar experience. I think it's broader than that. He wants to say, yeah, sometimes he says things like, we're in a face-to-face relation with the rest of humanity. So he's trying to kind of square the circle. He wants to say, yes, we should be universalistic, but there has to be that sort of immediate sense that we owe something to another human, other human beings, or to another human being.
Simon?
I think I'd just pick up on Anders' point that if we take an evolutionary perspective, empathy in humans has evolved. You know, we see sort of simpler forms of it in other animals. But empathy always occurs in the context of a very specific relationship. You know, you see the homeless guy on the street, or you see somebody has fallen into the lake, and you've got a very direct emotional response of, how can I help? But it's kind of a one-to-one. And that's probably why these photographs of individuals are such a powerful trigger. But you're really asking, how can we scale that up so that we're not just helping one person? And that's why I was arguing for a sort of hybrid approach, where we use our very, if you like, primitive emotional response to seeing somebody else in distress. But we also make use of big data, of information, to think about how can we help in the most effective way. And just kind of relying on one or the other might not be optimal, but a hybrid approach is probably a better way to go.
It's also a matter of error correction. Earlier you mentioned the problems that happens if you follow logic ruthlessly. And
yeah.
Most moral systems, if you sit down in a philosophy seminar, will very quickly come up with cases where they lead to the most outrageous and horrible conclusions. And that's typically all the fun in an ethics seminar. But in practice, we don't want people to follow through totally on the morality. And similarly, we have seen these problems with our emotions. Generally, we want to make sure that these systems act as error correction for each other. Because normally when we do reasoning, the probability of us reasoning wrong is fairly high. And especially about important things, we don't want to be wrong. So we need to either use very careful reasoning, or ideally several overlapping ways of checking that we got the right result. And this might also be true for our emotions. We might actually be feeling wrong in many ways. We might be having biases and framings that are actually not appropriate. So it's again useful to have multiple layers and see, do they point in the same direction, or are we getting some interesting contradiction that we might want to resolve?
Theme 3.
But do we all agree that perhaps we need to keep the data and the philosophy in the back room, as it were, and use empathy in the sort of front of house, you know, as charities often do with their advertising with individuals, so that we can achieve the result? Or do we think that we can actually put the data, the big picture, at the front of things, and actually tell people, actually, sorry, but let's just be rational about these, that this, do you want to help maximum number of people or not?
Yeah. I think I've sort of laid my cards on the table in terms of saying we should use both.
And I would say, without having that emotional drive to want to help others, it's pretty unlikely that you should care about the data. If I see that, yeah, I could donate and save 10,000 lives, but I don't care about those lives. Well, in that case, it doesn't matter that I know this fact. So there is an important role of emotion as a driver, as a motivator. And also when you go out and do something moral, it's one thing if it's very, very easy to do. It doesn't take an effort from you. Another thing if you actually need to work a bit on it. It's at that point you actually need that emotional driver. So in general, I think most moral problems are actually very unlike what we discuss in the philosophy department, because we get into the weird edge cases and the interesting dilemmas. But most of everyday moral problems are actually not a deep ethical issue. It's more, do I have the energy to be kind to that person? And that might be just more pure psychology or even drinking enough coffee.
Peter, are you happy with a hybrid?
Yeah, I think I'm happy with a hybrid. I mean, what I would say is that if we kind of lose the initial moral impulse, then there's a danger that even sort of altruism just becomes a kind of bureaucratic exercise. And people don't like being just treated as objects of bureaucratic operations, even when they're being helped. You know, there's something about that way of treating other people, even when it's supposed to be in their best interests. So, for example, to give an example with the jungle at Calais, you know, the people did not want to be moved out of their cardboard shacks into these containers that had been provided for them, even though ostensibly, you know, they might be in a more comfortable position. So I think there's always that problem. And to go back to what I was saying about Levinas, so Levinas talks about this in terms of the relation between the face-to-face relation on the one hand and what he calls justice on the other. And his basic idea is, well, if we ever lost that initial face-to-face, that initial moral impulse, even justice would become something kind of desiccated and anonymous and bureaucratic. So we always have to keep that initial impulse, which is getting things going.
Yeah, I completely agree. Yeah. I come from a land where we have kind of institutionalized compassion. on one hand, objectively, it works reasonably well. But there is also this annoyance, for example, the Swedes feel when they see beggars in the street. Why aren't they using the social security system? After all, it's there. You just need to fill out the right forms and agree on a certain assumed social contract. The fact that there are beggars in the street that don't get that help is kind of an insult, both to the system, and many Swedes, of course, have internalized a view that, yes, we have created this wonderful people's home that is going to help us, and also an admission of failure. It doesn't work for everybody, despite what our intentions. Which, of course, creates an interesting undercurrent of aggression. I personally believe one reason Sweden is moving very quickly towards a cashless society is so that you don't need to give any coins to beggars. Although it turns out that many of the beggars are now using the Swish system on their mobile phones. You can actually pay them anyway.
Okay. on that slightly disturbing note, I'd like to thank our fantastic speakers.
Thank you for listening to this Institute of Art and Ideas podcast. If you enjoyed this debate and want to carry on the discussion, visit iai.tv. Remember to subscribe and review on iTunes.